Representative Clyburn, I got to tell you, I am a fan of yours, so I don't want it to be very clear already, as I said earlier. I asked this question because what I didn't know until I began researching for our time together was that you are a minister's kid. How did that play into your role today, being a PK kid and doing what you do now?
Oh, very much so, very much so. You know, I was the first born, or at least the first successful to live. My father, I understand that there was one before me that didn't make it. But, you know, when you're growing up, the eldest son, you're living in the parsonage. And, of course, the church members feel is as invested in you as your family. And of course, it was just a foregone conclusion by everybody that I would follow my father into the ministry. My dad and I talked about it a lot. But I always heard he's supposed to be called to the ministry. And I kept listening, but I never heard the call. I told my dad that I did not think I was going to go to the seminary as we had discussed. The 60s had arrived. I graduated high school in 1957. So 1960, I'm about the end of my senior year in college. I had just ended my senior year, really, when I really got involved in the civil rights activities as a member, founding member of SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. We met in the spring of 1960 up in Raleigh, North Carolina, and the second meeting was in the fall of that year, October, down at Morehouse College. It was the weekend that I met King and John Lewis. That experience, we met for a group of us in a meeting with Dr. King that started at around 10 o'clock at night and was supposed to last for an hour. It was like 4 o'clock the next morning before we came out of that room. And I've never been the same. So the church, faith, have always been a significant part. When we were sitting in and marching at South Carolina State, every meeting, and I guess just because I was the preacher's kid, before we got started on the march or even at the gathering, they always called on me for an invocation. That was usually the extent of my speaking at these events. But I was always the one asked to do negotiating when we needed to sit down with the college president, B.C. Turner at South Carolina State, and with usually the adults when there needed to be something explained to them, they always got me to do the explaining. So and I always used my faith upbringing to get me through those conversations. And so I, to this day, consider my two favorite Bible verses, the Old Testament being Micah 6:8, and the New Testament being Hebrews 11:1. Faith, the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things unseen. So I tend to call on my faith quite a bit.
How do you keep your faith separate from your personal life, obviously? At the same time, you're representing us, if that makes sense. So how do you keep the two divided, or if you do at all, if that question makes sense?
Well, I don't know that I really keep them divided. I tell people all the time, my father preaches often from the Old Testament as he did from the New. My dad had a great respect for the Quran. He himself a fundamentalist Christian, but we felt, he used to say all the time, every religion was based upon one four-letter word, love. And that's just the way that I grew up. So if, when I talk about the Old Testament, Micah 6:8, for he shall know man that which is required to do justice, love, mercy, and walk humbly. I don't know that there's anything can be more succinct than that. And when I look at my political involvements today, I think about that often. I'm sitting in meetings even today, and I'm listening to people, and I'm trying to figure out whether or not I should stand to speak. I go through scripture. I go through my own experiences in my head before I ever stand up to speak. It's a guiding principle. It's a foundation upon which I make all my decisions, and of course, they guide all my expressions as well.
I got to tell you, as preparing for our time together, President Joe Biden's name kept coming up during my research time, and he basically has said, not basically, he has said that had you not been there, he would not be president today. When you hear him say that, what do you think?
Well, the first time I ever heard him say that publicly was really a bit shocking to me. He had said it in private meetings, small gatherings. But the other day when we were signing the, what was it? The Inflation Reduction Act. I was really caught off guard when he said it then. He was there, the whole country looking in, and he said that. Now, I just never respond to that. He said it. Several media people asked me about it afterwards, asked me, did you hear what he said? I said, yeah, I heard him. What do you got to say about that? Nothing. And I don't respond to that. Because you grew up the way I grew up, you always taught, I was always taught that you are to be an instrument of God's peace.
Yeah.
So I always looked at that endorsement as my being the instrument that facilitated that. There were several incidents that led to that endorsement being what it was. Now, I knew Joe Biden. He and I had discussions over the years, but my late wife was very, very sick and could not go to that fish fry that were 20 some odd candidates were in attendance. It was my biggest fish fry that I'd ever had. And that night after the fish fry, I said to her, I went home, I left Joe Biden at the fish fry.
Wow.
And the crowd had gotten real small. There wasn't anybody left but a few people working and the police officers. And I'm told that he stayed there until the last one left. But I went home because I wanted to chat with Emily before too late. So around midnight. And I said to her that night, I said, you know, we've had the most successful fish fry we've ever had, but we're gonna have a real problem. Over 20 some odd people running for president. Some of them are good friends of ours. What are we gonna do? She says, well, I don't care how many run in and how many are good friends of ours. If we're going to win, we better nominate Joe Biden. So she had given me those instructions 9 months before I made the endorsement.
Wow.
But what made it so emotional was an event that took place 4 or 5 days before when I went to a funeral of my longtime accountant. And encountered a lady there who I'd never seen before, who said to me, she asked me, she started off by saying, I got a question I need to ask you. And if you don't want anybody to hear the answer, you lean down and whispered in my ear. She was sitting on a bench in the front pew of the church. And she asked me, who are you going to vote for in this primary? And as she requested, I leaned down and said to her, I'm going to vote for Joe Biden. Mm-hmm. And she looked at me in a way that I have a hard time explaining and says, I needed to hear that, and this community is waiting to hear from you. And then when I left the funeral, there were people stopping me, and several people asked me about the upcoming primary. I mean, this is Friday. The primary is going to be 8 days from then. I just decided that I was going to make this endorsement, and I was going to do it in such a way to try to generate a surge is what I call it.
Yeah.
Well, you made the endorsement. It did create a surge, and it all happened. But I think, you know, and that whole thing about a woman on the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
When I asked him, or just said to him, I thought he needed to, this endorsement would work to his benefit if he could make that promise during the debate. Well, I got that from my three daughters, talking to them.
Wow.
And they told me that they thought that that would make a big difference in the minds of a lot of people. And it did. Mm. So those five women, three daughters, an acquaintance I had never met before, and my late wife, all added up to that endorsement.
The power of women. It's remarkable, man. That's all I can say. I think you know what I mean by that, by the way.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
You recently told CBS News, Bob Costa, that you said these words, that a dark place is on the horizon for voting rights. Can you please elaborate on that?
Well, I think that if we were to look at the history of things, let's remember what happened back in 1862 when Abraham Lincoln sat down to sign the Emancipation Proclamation to be effective January 1, 1863. That ushered in a period that we call the Reconstruction Era. A period that lasted a little over 12 years, close to 13 years, and it was gone. During that era, that 13-year period, former slaves became an integral part of the governmental process. They did so through voting. Here in South Carolina, 2/3 of our House of Representatives here in South Carolina was Black.
Right.
This is the only state in the Union that ever can boast of anything like that. We had four Congress people from South Carolina. Three of them were Black at one time. I tell people all the time I'm the ninth African American to serve in Congress from South Carolina. Before I was the first one, there were eight. Now, the problem is there's 95 years between number eight and number nine. Why? Because this country went into a dark place.
Yeah.
We started out calling it the Jim Crow. Here comes Plessy versus Ferguson, and it became separate but equal. And then Brown v. Board of Education in 1954 decided that was just downright unconstitutional. So 1954 brought us out of the dark ages as it relates to voting. Now, here comes Supreme Court decisions, getting rid of the 1965 Voting Rights. Didn't get rid of the Voting Rights Act itself, but it got rid of the potency of that. That has started us towards a dark place, because they came back 2 years later, maybe 3 years later, with another decision, because the first one, the hold the decision, that decision tackled Section 4 of the Civil Rights Act, rendered it null and void almost. Then the next decision went after Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. Now we just saw the Supreme Court of the United States, after a federal judge in Louisiana, said that this redistricting plan is discriminatory. The United States Supreme Court says, maybe it is, but we're going to have the election anyway.
Yeah.
That's what I mean. We're headed toward a dark place. We don't make one big decision like we did in Brown. We're watching it being done incrementally.
Wow, little by little there. I got, as someone who writes in this space, someone who interviews people in this space, I'm deeply concerned about the rise of Christian nationalism. And Marjorie Greene Taylor, one of your colleagues there, seems to be, you know, keep bringing it up here. Are you concerned about Christian nationalism and the rise of it?
Yeah, that one is incremental as well.
Yeah.
We've been playing footsie with the so-called evangelicals for as long as I can remember.
Yeah.
And we seem to feel that when somebody does something in the name of the Lord, it's all right. I remember a song back in the day called The Games People Play. And there's a refrain in that song says that people walking up to you singing glory, hallelujah, and all the time socking it to you and doing it in the name of the Lord.
Yeah.
I have not never forgotten it. I think about that song often. And that's what keeps happening. And so I say to my fellow travelers, we can't play games with this. You can't tell me that you are can be against my voting rights. And because you do it in the name of the Lord, that makes it okay.
Right.
So, and that's what's going on now. So I'm very concerned that we are allowing so-called white evangelicals to define and extent of religiosity in our country.
It's deeply concerning. As someone who lives in her backyard in the Atlanta, you know, portion of the city, it's alive and well, sir. And I told my wife this morning, I'm deeply concerned about this, that we've seen it long before the rest of the country is seeing it.
Oh yeah.
And she's the one who's going around just talking about it. Next, the last question here for you, sir. Man, the question that I kept getting asked over and over again, when I told folks I'll be spending time with you, they said, can you ask him, how does he stay so healthy? Like, you are balanced. You are at the same time. You watch your words when you're talking. You know, no offense, you're in your 80s and you're still with it. And they want to know, what is your secret? Like, what is the vitamin that you're taking every day?
Well, you know, being if this were not a religious session, I might admit to the libations I take every day, almost every day. But really, all that's for taste. I have not over the years had any organized what I would call a regimen. My brother does. My brother's 2 years younger. He goes to the gym every day.
Wow.
Now, I play golf a whole lot. If, you know, every weekend that I can, and in the middle of the week when I can find the time. But I've now started a sort of a treadmill routine, and that I have kept up. I'm very careful. I don't overeat, and when I take libations, I don't overdrink. I tend to really try to moderate everything that I do. I can still play 36 holes of golf a day, and
wow.
But I may go to bed earlier that particular night than I would ordinarily do. But other than that, I guess I've just been lucky. I've not had any real serious issues. I talked to my doctor this morning. I had a physical last Thursday, I guess it was. What is the day?
It's Tuesday.
Yeah, it was last week. And he called to give me the results today. And the results were very, very good. So I consider myself to be very, very fortunate. I maintain constant, regular checkups to make sure that I'm not getting out of whack. I do take, metformin. My wife suffered with diabetes for 30 years. So anytime there's any sign of an elevation of the sugar stuff, I take that pill every day for that. And I take a pill every day for cholesterol.
Yeah.
I took an aspirin, a baby aspirin, every day that I can think about it.
Man.
I've just considered myself to be fortunate.
I would say you're very fortunate. Last quick question here. How can we get ready for the midterm election? What advice would you give us?
My advice to that is, especially to those, and I don't know if you've ever heard this term, but have you ever heard the meaning of four P's?
No.
Blank, poor, prior planning. Blank, but well, I'm done with that. What I've been trying to do all over the country, I really believe that our salvation is the four P's.
Yeah.
Pastor, parish, precinct, projects. Mm. Pastor, parish, precinct, projects. Mm. You know, it has always been the Black church that's bailed us out as a people.
Yeah.
Always. Those, the signals that were required to escape from slavery came through him, swing low, sweet chariot. These things grew out of a search for freedom. And then once freed, the states didn't want to educate us. There are eight HBCUs in my district. I mean, seven in my district, eight in South Carolina. Benedict and Allen here in Columbia. Yeah. One's AME, the other is Baptist.
Yeah.
Claflin in Orangeburg is United Methodist. Voorhees down in Denmark is Episcopal. Clinton up in Rock Hill, AME Zion. Mm-hmm. But one of the eight state supported. There's one of the seven state supported, and the eighth one is a two-year technical college, Denmark Tech. Those two are state supported, but the other six, two Baptists, and the others among other denominations, AME, United Methodist, Episcopal, and AME Zion. So the Black church, I think, will be the salvation to this entire preservation of democracy. I really believe that this election in November will determine whether or not we continue our pursuit of a more perfect union or whether we fall into an autocratic abyss.
Man, I'm praying. I never thought of my day and time, sir, that I would be living what I'm living today.
No, no. There's no way to ever believe it.
I'm deeply concerned, and democracy is at risk.
Absolutely.
What anyone says on that.